The individual should own their data, and they should own the ability to say who gets it and what of their data they get and what they use it for. And frankly, that's not the situation of today.
Apple CEO Tim Cook, speaking to the New York Times earlier this month, Apple rolled out an update this week that lets users opt out of having their browser behavior tracked. Facebook, which makes a ton of money from its ads, was not pleased. We're going to talk about the dispute between these two companies in just a few minutes. But first, it is official. For the first time in history, California is losing a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. The 2020 census results unveiled yesterday show the state's population did not grow enough to add or even maintain its current 53 seats. We'll also lose an electoral vote come the next presidential election. The new census figures also mean California's legislative districts, both state and federal, will be redrawn. And that task falls to the California Citizens Redistricting Commission. Sarah Sadwani is one of the commissioners on the 14-member panel. She's also a political scientist at Pomona College. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, can you explain what happened? Because even though California actually gained in population, it is still losing a congressional seat. Why?
Yes, that's absolutely right. There is a fixed number of congressional seats nationwide, only 435 seats to be divvied up between the states. So the Census Bureau uses a population-based formula to decide how many seats each state gets. So that means if one state loses a seat, another one will gain. And while California's population grew actually by about 2.3 million people since 2010, that growth rate has been nearly flat since 2017. And that's ultimately what has led to the loss of one of those congressional seats for the state of California. It's ultimately a fixed pie that has to be divvied up between those states.
I see. And so while it did gain, it didn't gain as quickly or as much as proportionally as the rest of the country. A lot of people are thinking, well, our population may have been undercounted because there was all of this anti-immigrant sentiment whipped up before the census and a lot of fear perhaps whipped up and engendered so to dissuade people from participating in the census. Do you think that's part of it?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Madeline. And you know, since being seated in August of 2020, the commission has been advocating for a complete count of all Californians. There were, of course, many challenges in reaching all Californians. Many communities are simply not aware of what the census is or why they need to participate. And for a host of reasons, as you mentioned, right, for many undocumented communities or immigrant communities, there are many Californians who lack trust in the federal government and simply don't feel comfortable filling out government documents and providing their personal information. You know, the pandemic, of course, also added another layer of difficulties. People were shut in, outreach efforts were stymied, people were displaced, right? Like college students, many of whom had to return home around April 1st, which was census day. However, we do feel really confident in the heroic efforts that were made by California's Complete Count and many community-based organizations around the state that were working to reach out and help in the counting process around the state. And there had actually been talk of possibly losing two seats. So it could have been worse.
Uh-huh. It could have been worse. But more Californians actually left the state, California citizens, than came, moved into the state, right? They're moving to places like the Mountain West or Texas or Florida.
Yeah, certainly that's one part of the narrative, but there are many reasons that we can have fluctuations in the population. You know, we also have a declining birth rate and yet at the same time seeing increases in our death rate. So there's a number of reasons why we can see the change in population. Certainly moving out of the state could be one of those reasons.
Right. So myriad reasons. We are becoming, as you say, an older population and delaying birth as well. So what happens now? You are on the Citizens Redistricting Commission. What do you do now with this information?
Yes, that's right. So yesterday we received reapportionment data, and that's data at the national level that, of course, we can use to assess how many congressional seats each state will get. And now we're in a waiting pattern and waiting for the redistricting data. The redistricting data will bring down all of the top level data into census geographies, neighborhood level data that we can really use as the building blocks of forming districts. But in the meantime, while we wait for that data to come down to the state level, we have plenty on our plate to do. Much of the mandate of the Citizens Redistricting Commission is to have a very public-informed process. And so over the next several months, we'll be going out and listening to communities on the ground and hearing about where their communities lie, what kinds of communities want to be kept together, or even those that want to be kept apart. So there's a number of ways that the public can get involved and share that input with us. We've developed a community of interest mapping tool, some really simple mapping and easy to use mapping tools that are available on our website that communities can go even today and submit to us a map of where their community lies and you know, why they want their community to stay together in a district.
That's so interesting and so politically fraught because, as you say, it's a zero-sum game. Someone's going to lose a seat, right? So, and someone who's in Congress now could possibly lose their seat.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Certainly, right now we have 53 members of Congress from the Golden State, and we will in the future only have 52. But that doesn't mean we're going to go through the state and simply erase one district and spread out another one. Especially for the congressional map, it will require clearing the map and really rethinking where district boundaries should lie, based upon this new census data, but also based upon this communities of interest input, as well as thinking about our mandate to uphold the Voting Rights Act to ensure that historically excluded communities also have their fair chance at representation.
And you have to do this all before the 2022 midterms.
Yes, that's correct.
Good luck.
Yeah, thank you. We need it. We definitely have our work cut out for us in the next year.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Sarah Sadwani. She's a member of California's Citizens Redistricting Commission, and she's a political scientist at Pomona College. Two of the world's biggest tech companies are in a huge fight over you, or more specifically, your data. In one corner, there's Apple. The company is releasing a software update for iPhones and iPads this week. It will let you say no to tracking by apps. Apps use your information to show you ads as you cruise around the web. And that brings us to the other corner. And in that corner, Facebook. The Apple update could have big implications for Facebook's business model, which relies on ad revenue. Here to tell us more is Jack Nickas. He's a reporter for The New York Times. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, explain how this new feature works.
Sure. So basically, this week, as people who own iPhones and iPads update their devices, they will likely start to see an array of pop-up windows when they open up their apps for the first time. And these pop-up windows will ask them if that app can track the owner of the iPhone across other apps. And the expectation is that most people will decline that tracking. And that is what is getting Facebook so upset.
Well, explain how that works, because I think most of us think, yeah, we're tracked, but only tracked when we're on the particular app or website. But Facebook and others, they actually track us as we go to different websites?
Indeed. So sort of one of the dirty secrets of digital advertising is that a lot of these companies, and especially the big digital advertising companies like Google and Facebook, track us across the internet and across our phones. And essentially how they do that is they embed some technology that allows other apps to recognize us when we're on other apps or other websites. You know, when you're using an internet browser, it's called cookies. It's a little bit different technology with apps, but it's a lot of the same thing. And essentially what it allows a company like Facebook to do is to build out a much more precise and broader profile of us as a person and as a consumer, so that they can then sell that profile to advertisers so advertisers can more specifically target their ads. And that enables Facebook to charge more for their advertising space.
And it also enables Facebook to be free if we want to use it.
Exactly. So that is at the core of the argument between Apple and Facebook. So they really have two opposing visions of what the internet should be. Facebook promotes what it calls a quote unquote open internet. And that is essentially the version of the internet that I think many of us think of, which is, you know, a lot of the services that we use, Google, our social networks, email, have been free for a long time. But the way they can be free is because advertisers foot the bill. And so Facebook is arguing that in order to make that business model work, the advertising companies and the advertising platforms like Facebook and Google need a lot of data in order to be able to sell their ads at a rate that can make this profitable for them. Apple, meanwhile, has a very different view. Apple has tried to create its marketing pitch around getting consumers to pay a premium for an Apple product. Maybe you're going to pay $1,000 for an iPhone nowadays. But with that, you're going to get a more private and safe experience on the internet, and you won't be tracked as much. You won't be advertised to as much if you're willing to pay upfront, often to Apple.
Right. And they also have their own apps, and they want you to buy their apps on their app store or the apps that they sell on the
right.
app store.
Absolutely. These companies are so big now that there are so many ways that they compete, but also so many ways that they depend upon another. And that's why this fight has really happened, because Facebook relies upon Apple to reach consumers. So the iPhone is perhaps the most important platform and gateway to hundreds of millions of people for Facebook. You know, Facebook has WhatsApp, Instagram, and Facebook, all very, very popular, some of the most popular apps on iPhones. And but that also means Apple has an enormous amount of leverage over Facebook's business, and it allows Apple to make these sorts of changes, like, you know, stopping Facebook from tracking users. That hurts Facebook's bottom line.
Well, people are buying Apple devices anyway. Why is Tim Cook, why is Apple doing this now? Why do they feel like they have to do it now?
Well, I think I'm, as someone who reports on Apple, I do think that this is a good marketing pitch for them. They want to continue to promote the iPhone as a privacy-centric, safe place for their users. And if people are getting pop-up windows that say, don't let this app track me across other apps, that's good for the brand. At the same time, you know, Apple says that there's a moral decision being made here, and that Tim Cook, the CEO, morally feels that the advertising industry has really run amok, and it has gotten way out of control. And it's led to a lot of the bad things we've, I think, seen on the internet over the past several years, including misinformation, extremism, and a lot of, you know, data privacy issues. And so he, you know, him and his deputies are really taking a stand here, according to Apple, in order to try to give users a choice, in Apple's words.
Well, so how damaging could this be for Facebook, money-wise?
That we don't know. And it really, Facebook hasn't been completely clear on that. And to be honest, I don't think Facebook or the digital ad industry really has a sense of how big of an impact this will be until it really plays out. What we can say is there actually was a smaller fight over a very similar move by Apple several years ago, when Apple started blocking companies like Facebook from tracking users on Apple's Safari internet browser. And Facebook at that time said this would be terrible for our business. It ended up not being that big of a deal. But the other thing is Facebook actually also, you know, kind of reversed its position recently. Mark Zuckerberg said publicly that, well, actually, it might actually be good for us, but it's going to be bad for the smaller advertisers. So it's all sort of confusing, and we'll see how it all plays out. What we do know is the two companies are very much not happy with each other.
And is that a personal thing between Tim Cook and Mark Zuckerberg?
Well, you know, my colleague and I have been trying to understand this question and reporting on this, the relationship between the two men. And what we can say is certainly these are two very different men. You know, Tim Cook is sort of a polished executive. He's 60 years old. He's really made his legacy about, you know, constructing efficient supply chains. And Mark Zuckerberg is 36. He's a college dropout, and he's been about sort of an anything goes stance towards free speech and growth. And we have a couple examples in our story about this very chilly relationship between the two men. Most notably, the lead of our story is about one of the most recent times that they met face to face in July 2019. And this was just as Mark Zuckerberg was dealing with a lot of the fallout from some of the scandals Facebook was facing, like Cambridge Analytica. And Zuckerberg asked Tim Cook for advice. And Tim Cook basically said that Facebook had to delete all the information that it had collected about people outside of its core apps. And Zuckerberg was stunned because that basically meant Tim was saying Facebook's business was untenable. And Mark Zuckerberg ignored Tim Cook's advice.
And here we are. Well, Jack, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Jack Nickas, he's a reporter for The New York Times. Well, with another drought, the future of farming in the Central Valley is being questioned. We're going to find out more next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. What is the future of California agriculture in the Central Valley? That's the question a lot of farmers are facing as they face another drought. The region still hasn't recovered from the last drought, which went on for about 4 years from 2012 to 2016. And there's no knowing how long this one will last. Louis Sahagan wrote about this for the LA Times, and he joins me now. Hi.
Hi there.
Well, you begin your story with a farmer and cattle rancher named John Guthrie, and his family has been in the business for more than 150 years. What did he tell you about what he sees as his future?
What he told me about his future were sentiments that were echoing across this most productive farmland in all America, and that is that the future is grim. It's a bit more uncertain than ever. And he is also president of the Tulare County Farm Bureau, in addition to running a farm that's been in his family for 150 years. And he is ready to bow out of the business. You wouldn't expect to hear something like that from the president of the Farm Bureau. But he has come to feel that back-to-back droughts combined with new water restrictions and cutbacks in water allocations are making it almost impossible to make a living at farming in that area.
Why have there been cutbacks in water allocations?
There have been cutbacks in water allocations because of the dearth, the lack of snow on the Sierra Mountains range, which provides snowmelt for irrigation. That is the preferred source of surface water. But with less snow, that means ranchers and farmers have to start pumping water out of the aquifer, which had disastrous results in the last drought, 2012 to 2016, worst drought in recorded California history. So they're going to have to start pumping aquifer water again. Nobody wants that. For the first time, California is rolling out a law in that area that requires that all water taken out of aquifers must be replaced in those same aquifers by 2040. So farmers now are saying, well, wait a minute, I can't survive unless I turn to the aquifers, which results in land literally sinking as much as 30 feet in the last drought, and wells drying up in farm workers' communities that surround these farms. But at the same time, they're now looking down the barrel of this new state law, which requires sustainable groundwater pumping.
Well, I guess it's an impossible decision on the part of state lawmakers what to do with this shrinking resource. I mean, you can't continually pump the aquifers without replacing it, but then what do you replace it with if there's no rain or very little rain?
That's right. I was hearing, like the agriculture commissioner in Tulare County suggesting that we may be reaching a tipping point for agriculture in that area, which is pretty hard to imagine, isn't it? where we might see croplands yielding to a new future of, for example, factories and business parks and suburbs. That's a pretty hard pill for the agriculture industry of Central California to swallow. But they're facing back-to-back droughts, more regulations, aquifer restrictions, and the fact that these impoverished communities that surround them are watching their wells go dry or become polluted with fertilizer, with chemicals, with terrible things running off the farms that are sinking into the aquifer that they are using for drinking water.
And that drinking water, as you say, is getting harder to find as these farms pump from the aquifer. These local communities, their drinking water wells dry up.
Yes. And there's a reluctance, unfortunately, among nearby communities that are better off economically and that have clean water systems, a reluctance to hook up to some of these farming communities that were built almost haphazardly in some cases 70, 80 years ago. They don't want to take on that burden, even though the state of California is offering to pay the costs of hooking up to those communities in order to make sure those people continue to have clean water.
Do the farmers see a solution for this? Is there any way for California to redirect more water to their farms so they don't have to pump the aquifers?
The answer to that, I believe, is no, because that depends on, you know, Mother Nature's supply of snow, which, you know, winds up cascading down the western slopes of the Sierra's runoff and then diverted into surface, precious surface water for farming. That snow is no longer there in the quantities that it used to be. There used to be reliable amounts of snow on the mountains. There are no longer reliable amounts of snow, and now it's more rain than snow. And the rain comes earlier, and there's less snow when you need the snow melt. So no, there isn't going to, there are going to be more and more reductions in allocations of surface water, which means there's going to be more and more groundwater pumping and or more and more farmers pulling out or being gobbled up by the largest and wealthiest farms in the land. So there'll be fewer farms, less land being farmed, more people unemployed, and less food grown locally for dinner tables across the United States.
So we might get our agriculture more from Mexico or other parts of Latin America.
That's right, or elsewhere, which, you know, comes with its own issues. But this has been, you know, the heartland of agriculture for the country. I think it's produced roughly half of all the agricultural products in the United States for a century. This is now, you know, it's looking like that's coming to an end.
Louis, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
It's Louis Sahagan, reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Coming up, the acclaimed filmmaker Raoul Peck is here to talk about his new documentary about how America was founded.
We are the winner. We dominate. We are the discoverer. We are the one who said what is civilized and what is not civilized.
His four-part examination into white supremacy is called Exterminate All the Brutes. And a warning, there is some offensive language in the interview that's coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In his 2016 documentary, I Am Not Your Negro, filmmaker Raoul Peck explored racism in the United States through the words of James Baldwin.
If any white man in the world says, give me liberty or give me death, the entire white world applauds. When a black man says exactly the same thing, he is judged a criminal and treated like one, and everything possible is done to make an example of this bad nigger so there won't be any more like him.
In his latest project, Peck tackles a larger story, the origins of racism and white supremacy over 600 years. The result is a four-part series on HBO Max called Exterminate All the Brutes.
There is this one short, simple sentence that sums up the history of the Western world. Exterminate all the brutes. Free land was the magnet that attracted European settlers. But as a system, it requires the elimination of the natives. White supremacy made it possible for Europeans to think it was acceptable to enslave or exterminate other peoples.
Peck uses archival footage, old Hollywood movies, animation to tell the story. He also recreates historical scenes with actor Josh Hartnett as a white racist everyman. And as Peck narrates the film, he weaves in his own personal story.
As a filmmaker, I am compelled to stay hidden in the background. Restrained, moderate, balanced, judicious, neutral even. You learn to avoid becoming the subject of your film. It's not about you, unless the story is bigger than you.
Raoul Peck is Haitian, but grew up in the Democratic Republic of Congo, France, the U.S., and Germany. In the series, he includes home movies from his childhood, a childhood that could be an example of the colonialism he explores in the movie, giving the series the feel of a deeply researched personal essay. And Raoul Peck joins me now from his home in France. Welcome back to Press Play.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
Great to have you. And you say in the movie that the existence of this film is a miracle. How so?
It's a miracle for several reasons. First of all, at the beginning of the project, I was not at all sure that I would be able to deliver the film I've profoundly felt that I had to make because of the nature of the documentation, the boldness of the point of view. You know, basically it's to return and deconstruct 700 years of Eurocentric history. And how do you do that visually? How do you do that in a way that is accessible to everybody? And one of the way I found how to do it was to be totally personal, even intimate at times. It could not be just another film. It couldn't be just a game. It's not a game for me. And it's not a game for the millions, hundreds of millions of people who feel that they are on the other side of the movie.
How does your story fit in with your overall thesis in your movie?
Well, I think that's also the connection that allows me to be so sure of the story I was telling, because it's not just the fundamental books and scholar that were part of the project, Roxane Dambard Ortiz, Sven Lindqvist, and Michel Rolfe-Trouillot, whose work the film is built on. But it was also the plus 50 years of my life back as a young man and adult that is totally fueled into the film. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to invent them because I went through them.
And you mentioned three historians whose work you drew on for this movie as well, one of whom is a historian named Sven Lindqvist, who is also one of your dear friends. Yes. And he wrote a book also called Exterminate All the Brutes, which comes from the Joseph Conrad novel Heart of Darkness, where Kurtz writes a line, it's almost like an afterthought on an official report, yes. Exterminate all the brutes. How did you decide to use that as, well, the title of the movie, but also the lens through which you're looking at these hundreds of years of history of colonialism?
When I got my hands on Sven's book, for me, it was just like an explosion. It was everything I've been ruminating about, I've been thinking about, I've been angry about, I've been looking to explain better, was in his book. His book is very personal as well. is the result of his multiple years of traveling around the world and traveling as a human being, you know, not judging people. You know, he was there to learn and to encounter real human being. So this profound way of seeing the world was totally in sync with who I am and how I see the world. And it was clear that Exterminate All the Brute was the centerpiece, I would say. And then I knew that I had to go further back and also explain the beginning of the United States of America, that we have been taught was the biggest democratic dream on earth. And I had to, deconstruct that dream as well, because that dream is not just after Europe started colonizing everywhere that it stopped on the frontier with the United States. No, it was totally part of the same story. So I had to reconnect to the genocide of the Native Americans, and then slavery, and then all the other genocide that followed, like the Shoah, which people might think they have nothing to do with each other. That's exactly the contrary, because we were taught to separate histories as if there are different type of history. And because also history is always the one told by the winner. So mm-hmm. I had to put aside all this, and those three books I use are the perfect matrix to be able to tell my story in a very subjective way and a very personal way.
Right. Where did that idea come from? So you're linking the slave trade to the massacre of the Native Americans, to the Shoah, as you mentioned, the Holocaust. And the linking thread through all of that is white supremacy. Where did that idea originate?
There are several moments we can pin down for that. But one of the important one is around the 11th and 12th century, when the Catholic Church started sending the Crusades to the Middle East and basically ravaged everything and killed the Jews or sent them away in exile, killed Muslims. And out of that era, you know, there was a great accumulation of capital. And that was the fuel to start the whole ideology of discovery. The monarchies were able to finance a huge expedition, you know, trying to link the East with the West. You know, they didn't know that they were going to find America, you know, what became America. It was an accident. Imagine a guy coming on the shore of this incredible continent on which you have more or less 100 million people living, and the guy has the nerve to put his flag on the ground and say, "This belongs to me now." If you read the contract that Columbus signed with the king and the queen, it's a separation of a loot. You can have this part of the profit. I get this, you get this. They didn't even have the continent yet. During the Crusade, there was also a peculiar thing that where the Catholic Church would analyze, did you have the right blood, you know? And that was the first time in the history of this planet that blood, which will become skin after that, later on, was used as an instrument to say, do you belong or you don't belong, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was done by the state and the Catholic Church. And the Congress made it worse. And then it was, you know, we are the winner, we dominate, we are the discoverer. We are the one who said what is civilized and what is not civilized.
And so this idea that when you arrive in this foreign land and you discover that there are hundreds of millions of people living in this foreign land, you need to look at those people as less than human in order to justify exterminating them.
Of course, that's what the Nazi did as well, you know. That's what any genocide does, you know. We are all human beings.
killing another human being is always difficult. Mm-hmm. Like in the case of Rwanda, it took more than 30 years with propaganda, with laws, policies. That's exactly what the Nazis did as well. It took many years before they could really install the killing of Jews in Germany.
Yeah.
So, and the process is always the same. You have to dehumanize the person in order to kill it properly.
This human impulse to do that has been happening throughout human history.
It's not an impulse. It's politics, it's strategy, it's power in action. You know,
yeah.
It has nothing to do with human being or like that. No, it's power in action. It's about profit.
But that power has been wielded since human beings have formed societies and countries. I mean, even if it isn't innate, it feels like just because of the pervasiveness of it throughout human history, it feels like it's innate.
But it's not. I go through that in the film as well. You know, how do you create a village? How do you create a community? How do you create a society? And that implies that you protect the society. That implies that you, when you don't have enough food, you try to enlarge your territory. But there are many different ways to do that. Not said that because of your nature, you have to kill everybody else to get more food, especially if you are pretending to be a democratic state or a civilized people. I'm sorry, the first really democratic nation was Haiti, because the revolution in Haiti said every human being who set foot on the island is Haitian and is a free person. All the other revolutions, the French, the American, they didn't consider the slaves as part of the revolution.
Right. I mean, it's really interesting that you know the Haitian Revolution 1791. It was so successful. The slaves revolted. They managed to kick the French out. And this was happening in the same time period as the American and French revolutions. And yet we don't learn that history. We learn about the American and French revolutions.
You know, that's why we have this map in the film where you see how Haiti was the first. And through that first, Haiti enabled the liberation of all Latin America. That historical fact is silenced. What I did in my film is really to put out the bigger matrix of this whole 700 years history. When it's basically you are deconstructing everything you have known since you are a child. Suddenly, the world you are in today, you know, a few days after the verdict, we know, you know, I was sad somehow that we have to be joyous of something that should have been normal.
Mm-hmm.
That there is a guilty verdict because we have seen what happened. Imagine all the hundreds of thousands of cases where there was no camera. You know, since I am a boy, I know of cases of people being killed by the police and nobody could prove anything. So for me, that verdict says, my God, how many cameras you needed? How many witnesses you needed. So this win is the win that you could, you know, it would have, the country would have exploded, you know. That's what enables you to understand those stories. It's not a story that started like 10 years ago, 20 years ago. It started 700 years ago.
And it's interesting, sobering, and extremely thought-provoking to look at these current events, as you've just mentioned, the killing of George Floyd, through your lens, through the historical lens of 700 years of this, of white supremacy. Yes. And colonialism. Filmmaker Raoul Peck, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you again.
Raoul Peck, he is the creator of the 4-part documentary series on HBO Max right now. It's called Exterminate All the Brutes. Coming up, The Plant Doctor is in. We're going to get tips on caring for your pandemic houseplants. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, we have spent a lot of time indoors for, well, more than a year now. And maybe instead of going outside, you brought nature inside in the form of houseplants. You know them, you love them, you try your hardest not to kill them. Here to talk about our pandemic plants and what we may be doing wrong is the plant doctor himself, also known as Hilton Carter, the father to more than 300 plants. And the author of three books about the wonderful world of indoor plants. His most recent, just published, is called Wild Creations, Inspiring Projects to Create, plus tips and styling ideas for your own wild interior. Hilton Carter, welcome back to Press Play.
Thanks for having me back. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's great to have you back. Well, last we spoke was about a year and a half ago, and you told us that 300 plants was your limit. Seems like a very high limit. But anyway, has that changed?
That has changed. I mean, I've actually downsized my number. So I have a little over 200 plants in my apartment. So when we last spoke, I had a studio that I had plants in and also had my apartment. And since the pandemic last year, I actually got rid of my studio and transitioned into a smaller office. So some of the plants that were in my studio went there. And some of my plants I actually donated and gave away to people who I thought could properly care for them. So right now, in my control, in my care are about 200 plus plants.
That's still a fair amount. I mean, that's a lot of caring and tending.
Yeah, it's a lot of care, but if you're someone who's committed and ready for that challenge, I think it's something that can allow you to reap the real benefits of having plants. Now, I'm someone that understands my limit. Like I said, 300 then was my limit for how many I could care for, or my max. Like I have a cap on how many pets I'll have. I have two cats, I have one dog, and I'll never have more than two dogs. And honestly, I would never have more than one cat, but I have a wife and she loves cats. So that's how that
so
works.
So you could go higher in the cat department. But anyway, so we have, as I said in the introduction, spent a lot more time than we usually do indoors. And perhaps we've accumulated a few more plant friends. And what are some of the issues that you've heard about in the last year that people are contending with when it comes to tending their plants? Are they perhaps over-tending them because, well, there they are in front of them all the time and they don't have maybe anything else to do. And there are the plants.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I think the one thing that I put out into the world via Instagram early in the pandemic when we were all sheltering in place and just staying at home was just being very mindful. And I call these PSAs. They're called plant safety announcements, just to make sure that people were being aware that just because you were at home and you're going to be around your plant more often, doesn't mean that it needs more care. It still needs what you were already giving it when you were out at work, while you were traveling. It still needs that same sort of care. Just be mindful not to helicopter parent that particular plant or your plants, right? Now, while they might have saw a lot of, let's say, winds or plants developing and growing wildly over spring and summer, once fall and winter hit, that's when they saw a lot of the struggles start to take place, because for most of us, that's where we start to see our plants kind of lose a leaf here and there, or there's signs of struggle because there's less light, it's colder temperatures, things of that nature. So I think a lot of new novice plant parents did find their struggles in the fact that they maybe brought in too many at once, or they just weren't well-versed in the types of plants they were bringing into their homes.
Right. So I bet a lot of people think, okay, I'm just going to get this plant. It looks great in the store. I'm going to just put it in a pot, put some water, water it, stick it in a corner or in front of the window, what have you. And that's that. Maybe water it once a week.
Yeah, I would say that's probably, if I had to guess, I would probably say that's 50% of the people who are purchasing plants. That's their process. That's the thought process. It's a plant. It needs sunlight. It needs water. Boom, I got it. I'll put it in my home. And I think a lot of folks found themselves struggling through that and not understanding that it's all about thinking about light first and what type of light you have coming into your home. Mm-hmm. And the best ways to go about it, and I like to talk about this, talk about it in my books, especially talk about it in my last book, is the idea that before you actually go out and try to buy any sort of plant and bring it into your home, is to find the spot in your home where you want the plant to go. Like, that's the most important thing. So if you wanted to go in the kitchen counter, or if you wanted to go in the corner of your living room or in your bathroom, know that spot, and then based on the light that that spot in your home gets, then find plants that can then thrive in that spot. Don't just make decisions based on the fact that a plant is now super trendy, or you just really love the color and the shape of the foliage, or you were told that it's a low maintenance or an easy plant.
Well, speaking of trendy, what is the trendy plant right now?
The trendy plant? I mean, there's so many. While a lot of folks will say the fiddle-leaf fig fell out of fashion, and we talked about the fiddle-leaf fig last time.
We did, and you reprimanded me for where I put mine, I remember.
And I think you said that it used to be in style. I probably told you it's still in style. Guess what? It's still in style. But when it comes to like the it plants, I'm going to go with all of the designer, I like to call them the designer plants right now, those that have more, I would say, striking foliage, whether that's color variation, whether that's line quality. One of the biggest, I would say, trendy plants right now might be the polka dot begonia. That's one that you'll see more so if you're on social media right now. You might see more people posting about it. You might see it in more plant shops. You might see it popping up on different articles, magazines, maybe in TV shows. Another plant that I'm really fond of that I have in my home that I feel like is going to be a really super trendy plant. It's already trendy. The Birkin philodendron will be one. It's a beautiful, lovely vine-like plant. It starts its growth with these white leaves that unfurl, and then as they mature, they develop more green in them. And honestly, I think one of my favorite plants right now probably has to be the Rojo Congo. It's a bigger plant, a lot of beautiful foliage. It's kind of fast growing in a way, depending on where you place it in your home. And it's a really hardy plant. So it's difficult to bump into it and knock a leaf off or damage a leaf. Mm. It can really hold its own in your home. And I have one right now over my bed hanging in a plant hammock. So it's a really lovely plant. So those are the plants I would say are probably the trendiest at this moment. But every plant, if you give them some sort of push via social media, they'll find their way into the hearts and homes of a lot of the plant parents out there.
Okay, I want to wrap up with just one more recommendation from you.
Go for it.
It gets really hot here in Southern California. You're in Baltimore, so it's really humid in the summers, but here it's really dry and hot in the summer. What would you recommend for people who are feeling that they are ready to add in? Maybe it's their first plant, I don't know. But what would you recommend for our hot, dry summers here in California?
Hot, dry summers, you're seeing what is available outside of your home. If that's something that you want to bring indoors, you'll have a lot of success. So whether that's cacti, succulents, any of those desert plants, ZZ plants, snake plants, those sort of plants that love that sort of climate, you'll have better success with those. But if you're someone that's trying to create more of a jungle vibe, let's say in your home, and you're looking for tropical plants, you can, but you're going to have to bring a little bit of that climate into your home. So you're going to have to possibly add a humidifier. You're going to have to invest in a mister. The one thing to do is to try to always mimic what your plant gets when it's in its natural habitat, when it's out in the wild. So if you're going to bring in a fern, let's say, you want to keep it moist. You want to keep it in that sort of humid space. So thinking about having it in a spot that doesn't get, of course, any direct sun, keeping it in a spot that is going to be less dry. So maybe bringing in a humidifier and then always providing it with a bit of mist. So you can go across the board with any type of plant. It's just you're going to have to do the work to make sure it can then live in the space that you have for it.
All right. Thank you for that plant wisdom. I appreciate that.
Of course. Thank you.
That's Hilton Carter, aka the Plant Doctor. and the author of Wild Creations, inspiring projects to create, plus tips and styling ideas for your own wild interior. And that'll do it for us today here on Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.